This is an ABC podcast.
I'm Jonathan Green. You're listening to Lost and Found. And this week, we are going to Seoul, South Korea. If you're a fan of time travel, Seoul might be the city for you. It's a bustling, futuristic metropolis that retains at the same time a strong, deep sense of its history.
It's like just one step away from the busiest cluster of high-rise buildings, and you could just find yourself walking into the most calm and serene of ancient palaces and traditional villages.
Sojong Park is director of the Korean Cultural Center Australia.
It's a huge city. It's a metropolis with population of 10 million. But what's really remarkable about Seoul is it has transformed from the devastations of the Korean War to one of the world's most advanced cities. It's also the world's most digitally connected city, and it's also open to new technology while still placing value in maintaining its heritage and tradition.
But perhaps the best way to get to know Seoul is to try and see it as a whole and from above. Hyungmin Pai, critic, curator, professor of architecture at the University of Seoul.
I think the way I guide foreign visitors, international visitors, if they're up to it, actually, to take them up to the mountains. And so, I would talk about how Seoul, which was called Hanyang when it was first erected in 1394, Seoul has this sort of beautiful planning principles that is palpable within the city, and especially when you go up the mountains. And so the old city Seoul was surrounded by four mountains, and it was planned that way. So the founding royalty and monks cited Seoul because of its surrounding four mountains and then a central stream. And so the mountains vary in size and height. So the easiest mountain would be the West Mountain, and it's like an hour trip up and down, hour and a half. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you can see sort of like the old city, and then the surrounding further mountains. And you can see how the city was planned. So more than any other building itself or a group of buildings, it is the mountains that are sort of like the monuments of Seoul. And you can orient yourself. You know where you are. You know what the meaning of the mountain is. You know what the relation between the palace and the mountains are. And so I would take a healthy hiking up to the mountains. Some are more difficult. One mountain, the North Mountain, is a bit high up. So you really have to be sort of a hiker to go up. But other mountains, it's a very easy walk or drive up. And I would recommend somebody who really wants to be sort of part of Seoul to go up to the mountains and look. And you should take with you an old map of Seoul. And you can see how the city was planned and where the key palaces are, where the central sort of commercial financial centers are, things of that sort.
Look over the city and you'll see Professor Pai is right. And dividing the South Korean capital, well, that must be the Han. Sojong Park.
Han River, it's the major river flowing through the heart of Seoul, dividing the city into two, north and south. And lined with parks and recreational facilities on both banks, it is actually the perfect place for the people of Seoul to relax, bike ride, camp, and enjoy the high view of the Seoul skyline while eating Korean fried chicken and beer.
Sounds good. Mmm. Korean fried chicken and beer, two delicious food items that have been successfully exported to the world. But never fear if you're a teetotaling vegetarian, for you will be catered for as well.
Jonathan, like, contrary to what people know of Korean food, Koreans actually eat more vegetable than most cuisines. A lot of it is vegetarian based.
Heather Jong, chef, food writer and cooking teacher at the Korean Cultural Centre, Australia. What characterises temple food?
Oh my goodness, I would say that's one of the top of the ladder of like vegan food. So it's vegetarian, vegan,
yep.
And also they prohibit the use of five aromatic ingredients.
Oh.
Or like onions and garlic and chives and a couple more ingredients. It disrupts one's peace of mind.
Okay.
If you eat these very strong pungent aromas and flavors.
Well, so, okay, no garlic, but what should we expect if we sit down to a meal of temple food?
Well, surprisingly, the food is quite flavorful. It's simple, but very refined, and it's amazing. Typical dishes are, you know, what you expect from Korean food, but more focus on seasonality and regionality. And you can have kimchi. You know, people expect kimchi to be full of garlic and ginger and shallots, and it is. But for temple kimchi, it doesn't have any of that. The focus is on the ingredients.
That's such an interesting thing in cooking, in particularly in a lot of Asian cuisines, of simplifying, and often the Western mindset to that is to overcomplicate.
Yes, that's right. And I just love the philosophy, philosophy of the Buddhist temple food is the yourself and nature, it's all one. So the ingredients, for example, a cabbage is not just cabbage. It embodies these broad leaves of cabbage, capture all the energy from the sun, and you respect these ingredients. And even when you're slicing the vegetables, you got to keep your knife sharp so that it doesn't bruise the leaves as much. So it's just an amazing, you know, philosophy about food.
So this is a city that's always had a strong plan, has always had a real guiding principle.
Yes, of course. Yes, yes. That's and it was a beautiful plan in the sense that it was not like this rigid classical plan. So if you go to Beijing, which is sort of like a gridded classical Chinese plan, it had those Confucian principles, but the founding fathers also, they had the wisdom to adapt to the topography. And another strong principle was feng shui. Mm-hmm. We will pronounce it Pung Su in Korean, but it follows the same Chinese characters as Feng Shui, as you would know in Hong Kong or other Chinese cities.
And how does the city align itself with those principles?
So you have these four mountains, and then you have the North Mountain is the main mountain. And so that you put that on the back. And then you have an auspicious water, a stream in front of you. And the main palace would be placed there. And that's called the Gyeongbok Palace, which is the main palace. And Seoul is basically a political city. It was never a kind of commercial city based on economic sort of trade, like you see in the Western medieval cities. So it's a kind of political, symbolic place. And so the main attractions are the palaces, and there are many of them, all very quite different. And so the first thing you do is go up the mountain, see where the palaces are, learn about the history, why there's so many palaces, all the intrigue and people trying to kill their fathers to get. And so the king would sort of hide away and build another palace and that kind of story. And then you have the ritual Confucian shrines and then the gardens and all the sort of historical background to the city is embodied in these palatial and Confucian shrines.
there are 5 royal palaces in Seoul. And then the Gyeongbok Palace is the official main palace for the king and royal families. The Changdeokgung Palace is the second royal palace. It's written or said that the king even liked the Changdeokgung Palace more than Gyeongbok Palace, some kings. And I like to recommend you to participate in the Moonlight Walk program of Changdeokgung Palace. It's almost a rear when you escape from the old bustling noises of the city and walk around the palace and look at the night view of the downtown while the full moon looks over the palace. 사랑을 했다, 우리가 만나. I have worked at the Korean Culture Ministry just opposite the Gyeongbokgung Palace. So one of the perks working just opposite the Royal Palace, it's you can always you can see palaces every day and take a really nice stroll just lunchtime or after work. So it was really
that's a great treat.
Yes, yes.
Wonderful to have daily access to a palace. That's what we dream of. Seoul not only allows visitors the opportunity to visit the homes of royalty, it allows you to feast like royalty too. Heather Jong again.
Hanjeongsik is a Korean degustation. It's based on royal court cuisine, and this is where Koreans go to celebrate an occasion or event. It'd be more than 20, 30, sometimes 50 dishes.
Wow.
That come. And the traditional way to eat for Koreans is just everything at once. And it's like a buffet for one on a table. So there's a saying that we've actually made the spread so that the dining table legs are going to collapse. That's a traditional saying. And you'd expect little appetizers like a little congee that's seasonal, using seasonal vegetables, and then a cold meat or seafood. Also, sweet potato noodles with various vegetables that would make an appearance. Some seafood hot pot, and then you have meats that's braised or barbecued, steamed fish. And when you're so full that you can't eat another bite, they give you rice and various side dishes.
Oh boy! So everything's on the table. Is it polite to go sort of one dish at a time, or can I mix and match things on my plate?
Of course you can mix and match. I mean, the robust way of Korean food is not just double dipping. We actually do multiple dipping. But with Hanjeongsik, it's more refined. And we do have one course at a time. But sometimes, it's another course comes up before, you finish one course.
Okay.
And of course you can, go back.
What's your personal favorite?
Yes, there's a dish called gujeolpak. Ku means 9, and jeolpa means like 9 in a pan. What it is, there's a small crepe-like pancake, rows and rows of it, in the middle of this pan with 8 finely julienned vegetable and meat and seafood ingredients. And you're actually, placing these finely julienned, the most delicate thing ever. You're placing all these ingredients in the crepe. And you roll it yourself, and it's like the sum of its parts is definitely more than its parts. It's just exquisite dish. And it's very labor intensive, Jonathan, so that's why I like going to Hanjeongsik restaurants and eat them.
Somebody else has done this work.
Yeah, someone else.
Wow, fantastic, baby.
In its modern development, as you say, a city of 10 million people, have those historic principles been respected?
In effect, right now, you can still read these principles.
Hyang Min Pai.
Despite of all the modern, I think it was unfortunate, 1980s, 90s, a lot of the old city was destroyed in the city center, but still After the 1990s, a lot of a more mature, sophisticated society that respects its history. And so after the 90s, we've really sort of done a good job of protecting the old city, though a lot of it has been destroyed. And so you can still read it. There's been restoration work. For example, the auspicious stream that runs central, that's been renovated. It's been it was a highway during the 1960s, but they took it down and restored the stream. And so, the past 3 decades, Seoul and Korea has done a good job in trying to get that historical nature of the city back.
Now, before we head across the river, Sojong recommends we make another stop to soak in a bit more of old Seoul.
So I would like to recommend to go to Bukchon Hanok Village. The Hanok Village, it's located on the top of a hill between the two royal palaces, Gyeongbokgung Palace and Changdeokgung Palace. Bukchon Hanok Village is a home to hundreds of Korean traditional houses called Hanok and little winding alleys. The name Bukchon literally means northern village because it lies north of the two significant Seoul landmarks, Cheonggyecheon Stream and Jongno. So it dates back to Joseon Dynasty, but it has been maintaining its name, Bukchon, the northern village, since Joseon Dynasty.
Are people still living in those old houses?
Yeah, people are still living inside the Hanok in this village. So visitors are usually advised to be very quiet and respectful at all times. And 73%, most of the buildings in Bukchon are intended for residential use, but there are some other buildings for the commercial use. Yes.
It's a very precious thing to have survived, to be preserved.
Yes. While we are waiting for the international borders to reopen, I would just recommend those who are here in Australia to visit the Korean Culture Center just opposite Hyde Park in Sydney, because we have a life-size replica of the Hanok Korean traditional house, which is modeled on actual 17th century building in Korea. So I hope just everyone can just enjoy looking at our permanent installation of Hanok.
Over the last 20 to 30 years, the city of Seoul has been adding to our ideas of what a global city is like. Its dynamic, its growth, its influence of culture locally and worldwide.
Chinese media journalists coined the term Hallyu to say that there is a strong wind or a wave blowing from Korea.
Kyung Hyun Kim, creative writer, film producer, professor in the Department of East Asian Studies and Visual Studies, the University of California, Irvine.
That's making its way to mainland China, appealing to young audiences in the form of drama, music, and food and lots more. All of a sudden, Korea, anything that had to do with Korea became really cool. So they observed this and said, there's a Korean wave blowing. A large part of it, I wouldn't say all of it, because you can't force young people to consume things they don't like, no matter how much money you're ready to fork over. So, it certainly wasn't that easy in the beginning. But I think what ended up happening was government basically invested a lot of money in the cultural infrastructure. So actually they gave lots and lots of money to the training ground. So they have culture, music, and art universities, as well as high schools and academies that basically produce a lot of these artists over the last generation, I would say, that have paid off. Make 'em whistle like a missile.
Bomb, bomb. And then, of course, you have the Gangnam area, the new sort of bustling, sort of modern, hyper-modern area south of the Han River. Gangnam, the word itself, Gangnam, is Gang is river, and then Nam itself. So that southern area is where all the rich people and the high-rise apartments and the boutiques and the entertainment is there. And so in a way, that new development helped to protect, I think, the older parts of the city.
Hang on. Gangnam? That sounds familiar.
Oppan Gangnam Style! Gangnam Style!
Ah, yes, of course, the first music video in the world to garner over 1 billion views on YouTube. And this is the place it was talking about.
It is a really trendy, modern, and affluent southern part of Seoul, which was built in only like last 40 years. So it's like if you get out of the most iconic Gangnam's subway station, like Apgujeong, and you'll immediately see luxurious department stores and fancy restaurants and apartments, buildings, and it's really, really modern and trendy area.
You really need to be loaded with money in order to afford to live there.
Kyung Hyang Kim.
You know, so that's part of the reason why it got caught on, you know, as this epicenter of, you know, cultural attraction of a place that is equivalent of, let's say, you know, Beverly Hills out here in Los Angeles, right? So people are basically proud of it. People are also jealous of it. And I think this song leans toward jealousy. So it was basically a parody of Gangnam, the rich people and the, you know, sort of the nouveau riche, if you will, of Koreans. And it was a satirical kind of take on, again, crass capitalism. It was interesting how that kind of, I don't know, inside joke about Koreans being too crass and too commercial became a worldwide fad, you know? I don't know if globally caught on, it actually retained that kind of essential, I don't know, poking fun at people who are, you know, senselessly rich. I mean, that was the precursor, I think, you know, things to come, right? More, because I think that did a lot to the Korean wave.
In the end, of course, there's sort of like social inequality because the real estate prices of Gangnam is so, so high.
Hyangmin Pai, again.
But the Gangbuk, Buk is north. That area has its historical qualities. It's one of the most beautiful cities in the world. And in that sense, if you know your way, you can find sort of immensely beautiful, you know, combination of nature and architecture in the north part of the city. But you have to sort of find your way. It's sort of like in the mountains, hidden in between. So you should. I will tell you when you come by after the COVID-19.
You may be my guide.
I will tell you where to go.
Seems like our time is wrapping up in Seoul, but you know what they say? There's always time for a snack. Heather, what would you recommend?
Oh, there's so many, Jonathan. I can't really choose. But of course, you know, we can't talk about street food in Korea unless we talk about tteokbokki, which is sort of our chili rice cakes. It's just everywhere, and it's just my personal favorite. And also pindaetteok, which is mung bean pancake, which is absolutely like so delicious that I could eat it every day. That's yes, that's sort of sold in so many street corners, but there's so many markets in Korea, in Seoul, that, you know, I just can't pick.
You've been listening to Lost and Found, this time in Seoul. You heard from Sojong Park, Hyangmin Pai, Heather Jong, and Kyung Hyang Kim. Producers are Mira Adler-Gillies and Lisa DeVisi. Technical production by Brendan O'Neill. I'm Jonathan Green. Oh, yeah.
그녀간 주지 못하게 해 남자들의 궁위 여자들의 가실 유머를 자신감을 불만해 난 보란듯이 너무나도 뻔뻔히 네 몸속에 파고드는 엘레지 이상한 정신의 술렁이네 천지 오늘 여기 무법지
불을 질러 심장을 태워 널 미치게 하고 싶어
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listener.